There is one more aspect of Stoicism which I want to discuss this morning, and then we will leave this topic and go on to a discussion of Thomas More's Utopia. The topic that I want to discuss this morning is an extremely important one and serves as a bridge between what we've been talking about up to today and the discussion of the Utopia and Locke's Second Treatise. Let me introduce the subject by reading to you the famous Invocation to God written by Cleanthes. Cleanthes lived in the 3rd century BC. He was the successor to Zeno, who was the founder of the Stoic school of philosophy. Cleanthes, like so many of the other Stoic teachers whom we've mentioned, was born in Turkey, and he came to Athens and became a famous teacher in the Stoa. Now, this invocation to God or invocation to Zeus has played an extremely important role in the literature and the thought of Western society. And at some point in your education, you ought to be exposed to it. It's not very long. Let me read it to you and then move on from there to a discussion of its contents. Hail to thee, Zeus, most glorious of immortals, God of many names. This phrase, God of many names, appears later in the New Testament. I think in St. Paul talking or writing to the Athenians, I've forgotten, I should have looked it up, but I think it was in one of his epistles, tells the Athenians that God has many names, as they well know, and the God in whose name he speaks is the same God of whom others have spoken, though that God had many names. It's a great advance in religious understanding, knowledge and teaching to be able to recognize the identity of God, though he may appear under different names. Hail to thee, Zeus, most glorious of immortals, God of many names, almighty forever, sovereign of nature, who dost govern all things with law at thy side. Thee all mortal men may invoke, for they are thy offspring, alone of all creatures that live or creep on the earth. And to men it is given to have the likeness of echoes of thee. Wherefore, with my voice, I will hymn thee and ever sing thy power. To thee, all this universe, as it revolves round the earth, pays its obedience wheresoever thou guidest it, and it is willingly ruled by thee. Without thee, O God, nothing comes to pass that is done on the earth or within the divine vault of heaven or in the sea, save the things that are done by the wicked in their own folly. Well, there's the thought we've expressed time and again, that only evil is not done by God. With respect to everything else, God in some way plays a role in the laws of the universe and in the laws that guide men to goodness. But God is excluded. He excludes himself from the acts of evil done by wicked men. Thou knowest how to make the odd even and to turn disorder into order. What is not dear unto others is dear unto thee. And thus thou hast blended all things harmoniously in one, the good and bad together, so that there should be one reason from everlasting to everlasting through all things. That is, that even the bad make a contribution to the total good in the universe. And there is one reason. The whole universe operates on the principle of reason. All mortal men who are evil shun this one reason and pass it by, ill-starred beings that they are. Yea, those who are always coveting the possession of things, neither see nor hear. And here's a very famous phrase, the common law of God. We'll talk about that. The common law of God, which if they but obeyed it with an understanding mind, would bring them to a good life. But instead, they go their way in their folly, drawn by their impulses to one evil course after another, some running into a passion for glory that breeds unhappy strife, some turning their minds in disorder to the making of gain, some bent on enjoyment and the pleasures of the body. They are carried about now here and now there, in spite of all their great longing, for the very opposite of such a fate. But do thou, O God, the giver of all gifts, Zeus, who hidest thyself in dark clouds, who hurlest the flashing thunderbolt, do thou save men from their sore ignorance. Scatter it, O Father, scatter it away from their souls. Grant that they may attain wisdom, the wisdom which in thou puttest thy trust as thou governest all things with justice at thy side. So, being honored by thee, we shall honor thee in return, hymning thy works without ceasing, as befits every mortal man. For neither to men nor to gods is any greater gift given than always to him, as is just, the common law. As the great hymn to God is a hymn for the common law that is operative in the universe. Now, I don't have to point out to you how you could see yourself how important and how great this invocation is, and how many echoes there are in it from other things that we've read, from the starting with the Bible. Now, the common law, which is what I want to talk about now, that Cleanthes praises, is the unwritten law which Antigone referred to. Socrates bore witness to it. It is the unwritten law which the Bible assumes when Cain murdered Abel, his brother. It was assumed that he violated that unwritten law. It was the unwritten law for Noah, the sons of Noah, the children of Noah, for Abraham. It's the unwritten law by which Pharaoh was judged and condemned. It was made by God, this is the belief. It is rooted in nature, the nature of man. The nature of man, which is rational, that's what defines man as a rational, moral being. To the Stoics, who became the chief teachers of this doctrine and the great transmitters of this teaching. This law, this common law, which is universal, that's what makes it common. Common means common to all men. This law is rooted in rationality. The law must be rational. It must be a reflection of the mind of God in which man participates through his own mind. It cannot be the expression of passion, of willfulness, of whim, caprice, power, naked power, greed. It has to be a rational law, one that could be justified before a tribunal of men who are guided by rational principles. It is the same kind of rationality which makes the universe a cosmos, something that operates on the principles of law, which can be discovered when one studies nature. The universe constitutes a rational order. Now, it is part of nature, and therefore it is sometimes spoken of as a natural law, this common law. And for that reason, it is valid everywhere. Everywhere without regard to the differences that may separate men one from another. Everywhere without regard to race, without regard to nationality, without regard to differences of religion, or to sex, or economic status. The phrase to live according to nature, which is basic in Stoic philosophy, and one which you have seen or will see plays an all-dominating role in More's Utopia and then in Locke's Second Treatise, so that in a way I'm already anticipating those works and speaking about them. To live according to nature doesn't mean to live in the country as distinguished from living in the city. Living according to nature means living according to reason, which is the nature of man, which is part of the nature of the universe, which is also built according to reason. The laws of nature or natural laws are called natural because they are not laws on account of conventions, on account of agreements, on account of customs. They are natural because they haven't any other basis except nature. Except when you talk about who the author of these laws is, then you can speak of them as Cleanthes does and as all the other Stoics did, as divine laws. They're God's laws. They're God's laws because he is ultimately the author. But if you don't want to speak about where they come from, about the authorship, and more often than not, then you speak of them as the laws of nature or as that body of law called natural law. They're sometimes spoken of as the moral law. Moral law because the nature of man is to have a law which will dictate how he is to conduct himself in relation to himself and his relation and in relation to society, which of course is what moral law is all about. So that these laws of nature can be variously denominated moral laws, divine laws, natural laws, but they all mean the same thing, except that they point to different aspects of the same phenomenon. Now, men are all subject to this law equally. No one is exempt from it. No one is above it. No one is outside of it. Men are all subject to it equally because they are equally men, citizens of one universe. There are not different universes. Women don't belong to another from the one that men belong to. Oh, white people don't belong to one universe and black and other people to another. There's only one universe. And therefore, all men are citizens of that one universe and are all subject to one law. The logic of it, the argument, was beautifully stated by Marcus Aurelius in the Meditations. I may have read this passage to you in another context. I don't recall. But let me read it to you in this context. If mind is common to us all, just listen to the logic, to the argument. If mind is common to us all, mind or reason, then also the reason whereby we are reasoning beings is common. If this be so, then also the reason which enjoins what is to be done or left undone is common. The one reason acts in the same way with respect to its commandments for all who participate in the one reason. If this be so, law also is common. If this be so, we are citizens. If this be so, we are partakers in one constitution. If this be so, the universe is a kind of commonwealth. Now, commonwealth means one republic, one government, common. We don't often think of what the word means, but the emphasis is on the commonalty. For in what other common government can we say that the whole race of men partakes, except the one commonwealth? And thence, from this common city, that is, from this common republic or state, is derived our mind itself, our reason, and our sense of law. Or from what else? For as the earthy is in me a portion of the earth, and the watery in me comes from a second element, and the vital spirit from some source, and the hot and fiery from yet another source of its own, for nothing comes from nothing, just as nothing returns to nothing, so therefore the mind also has come from some source. You see how beautifully he tries to argue this out and to show the links in a chain. And he ends up, of course, with the idea of the mind having a common source, which is God. Now, this common law, as I want to emphasize, and here's an emperor who could have taken a different position, but he took the position that it is not power, it is not naked power. The law has to be an expression of the very essence of man. It has to be true to man's nature, which is reason, and the moral law. Any man-made law, this was the common belief of the Stoics, and you could easily identify its importance for us. Any man-made law that contradicts that common law is not true law. The common law will not tolerate any such notion as my country right or wrong. If it's wrong, then it is not true law. It only pretends to be law. And there is the difference between appearance and reality. There are lots of commandments that have the appearance of law, but they are not true law. Now, the clearest statement of this idea was formulated by Cicero, who died in the year 43 BC. In his Republic, Cicero wrote a work which he called, like Plato's Republic, the Republic. He wrote the following brief passage, which has played a very important role in the development of political theory. There is, in fact, he wrote, there is, in fact, a true law, namely, right reason, which is in accordance with nature. It applies to all men. It is unchangeable. And it is eternal. By its commands, this law summons men to the performance of their duties. By its prohibitions, it restrains men from doing wrong. Its commands and its prohibitions always influence good men, but are without effect upon the bad, as they are bad because they are indifferent to this law. To invalidate this law by human legislation is never morally right. Nor is it permissible ever to restrict its operation, and to annul it wholly is impossible. Because no legislature can change it, let alone annul or violate this common law. Neither the Senate nor the people can absolve us from our obligation to obey this law. And it requires no Sextus Elius to expound and interpret it, as all men, if they only sat and listened to their own reason, could learn what that law is. They don't need an external teacher to tell them what it is. It will not lay down one rule at Rome and another at Athens, nor will it be one rule today and another law tomorrow, but there will be one law, eternal, unchangeable, binding at all times, binding upon all peoples. And there will be, as it were, one common master and ruler of men, that is God, who's the author of this law, its interpreter, and its sponsor. The man who will not obey it will abandon his better self, and in denying the true nature of a man, will thereby suffer the severest of penalties, though he has escaped all other consequences, which men call punishment. As he may flourish, he may be wealthy, he may be healthy, he may have a reputation, but it doesn't matter. If he violates this law, while he may escape the punishment which he may escape the consequences which men call punishment, he has imposed upon himself through his own nature, which he cannot shed, the severest of all punishments, as he has excluded himself from humanity by the violation of the common law of humanity. Now, of course, countless commentaries have been written on these passages that I've read to you this morning. They still occupy our time. They are still fundamental. They are reflected, of course, in the Bill of Rights of the United States Constitution. They are reflected in the Nuremberg trials against the Nazi criminals for crimes against humanity. There were no written laws that the Nazi criminals violated. This was a defense that they offered, but the Nuremberg Tribunal overruled that defense. Murder is murder. You don't need a written law to declare it to be murder. And genocide is genocide. And one didn't need to have a law to declare it a heinous crime against humanity. And of course, it is contained as a basic element in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, on which, at least nominally, all nations have agreed as a common law for a common humanity. Every time a man claims that he justifies civil disobedience by reason of a higher law, by reason of his conscience, knowingly or unknowingly, he goes back to these sources, to these teachings. Now, I'd like to caution you that there is nothing in what I've read to you or said to you thus far which says anything about natural rights. We've been talking about natural law. Natural law was concerned with duties. Of course, by implication, rights. If you have a duty not to kill me, I have a right to live life. But the emphasis in the ancient philosophers, and this continued to be the case until modern times, was on the duties rather than on the rights of men. But the two go together. It's a question of emphasis. Do they have any, do the Stoics have an expression with respect to unnatural law? I don't know what you mean by unnatural law. A law that violates the natural law was not law. It was not true law. Now, they did not. I'm glad you asked this question. The Stoics did not develop any institutional thinking with respect to what to do when there is a law, that is what pretends to be a law, which is clearly violative of what they called natural law. The only resources are those which we've talked about that have played a role in Stoic thought and after Stoic thought. And that was to, well, I'll come to it in another context in just a few minutes. But let me put it to you this way. To do what Socrates did, to do what Antigone did. As you can't force me to do something which I consider to be so basic as to constitute a natural law for me, rooted in the nature of man, of whom God is the creator. This was the position of Antigone. This was the position of Socrates. Oh, this was the position taken by some figures in the Bible, the midwives that I mentioned to you in Egypt, who were ordered by Pharaoh to kill the Hebrew male children upon birth. They said they feared God. Well, it's an expression of the same thing. Now, if you want to kill me, you kill me, but I will not be compelled to do what I consider to be a violation of natural law. The Stoics built up all kinds of of defenses around themselves. You're the tyrant, and you order me to do something which clearly is a violation of natural law. Well, you want to take my property from me? Take it. You want to take my reputation? Take it. Take whatever you want. You want to hurt me? You want to cut off an arm? Cut it off. You want to kill me? Kill me. But you will not make me do it. Of course, the examples we've had and the examples we will have, Thomas More practiced this. I'll explain this to you a little later. And of course, he was beheaded by Henry VIII. Catholics, Protestants, Christians, Muslims, you name them. But there have been millions of people who've taken a position. And they said, we would rather die than do what you order us to do. You may be the king, you may be the emperor. It doesn't matter. We recognize God as our ultimate king. He's king over you. You refuse to recognize him. That's your problem. But you will not make us do what you are commanding us to do. Now, from that, we have developed the theory, the philosophy, as you have it in Thoreau, as you have it in Gandhi, of civil disobedience. They all emphasize the duty of civil disobedience, not the right of civil disobedience. It's a duty which a man has if he only recognizes himself as a man in the context where he is hard-pressed by an oppressor. But you don't have that philosophy developed on a theoretical level. It's implicit in the Stoics. I'm glad you asked this question. I should have made this clarification. Are there any other questions? Let me try now at this point quickly to summarize Stoic thought, and then we will take up Thomas More's Utopia. And as I said to you, I've already talked, in fact, about Thomas More and his Utopia, but I will do that more elaborately, of course. First, the contributions of Stoic thought, if I can try to reduce them to a few propositions. The stress on the ideal of the self, self-reliance, self-respect, self-awareness, including the probing of oneself, as you have it in the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. Based on the idea of man's moral responsibility for his actions, therefore he must know himself in order to arrive at an understanding of himself and his responsibilities as a man. And of course, impliedly, that man is free, ultimately free, to choose the good and to defy evil. He may have to pay a price, even including his life, but he always can defy authority which commands him to do an evil act. Secondly, the idea of a single mankind, a single humanity, God as the one Father, by implication all men, therefore constituting brothers, one unto the other. And therefore the social nature of man, man is related to others as brothers are. Thirdly, the idea of a common moral law for all men, everywhere. An unchangeable law, a law which cannot be repealed or amended. by Hitler or Mussolini or anybody else, no matter how strong he may be. Or by a democracy, by people getting together and all except one voting in favor of such a misuse of their power. Fourthly, and here I come in part to the answer to the question, I was going to put it in another context, but let me mention it here. The idea which you find on almost every page of Marcus Aurelius, Epictetus, particularly Epictetus, the idea of a man needing to have moral courage, the idea of freedom from fear, not to be afraid of what the other man will do to you. This is an indispensable, from the Stoic point of view, adjunct of the belief in self-reliance, in a man's moral responsibility, and in a common moral law. Let me read to you a brief passage from Epictetus on this. No one can hamper me. No one can force me to deal with other men otherwise than as I want. Who then has authority over me? Philip the king? Alexander the king? Where can they get the power? For the man who is destined to be overpowered by a man must long before that have been overpowered by things. Therefore, the man over whom pleasure has no power, the man over whom evil has no power, over whom fame or wealth have no power, and who, whenever it seems good to him, can spit his whole paltry body into his oppressor's face, whose slave can he any longer be? Whose subject? It's a wonderful statement of the inherent dignity of, to give you an example of Gandhi standing up before the British Empire. And the whole world recognized that here this almost ugly little man, inconsequential, to look at him, you saw practically, you know, nobody. You would pay no attention to him. He had the whole British Empire facing him, and he faced the British Empire with all the power that the British Empire had. And he had the dignity, he had the moral courage, and the whole world recognized that. We saw it in Martin Luther King. The whole world recognized it. There's something about the moral courage when it is exercised. You don't need to have the personality. Gandhi didn't have the personality. He was the person. Never mind his appearance. And this is what Epictetus wrote about here and the need for it. This to them was ultimately the sanction. This was the protection, the armor that a man needed. Finally, a point that I hadn't mentioned before, but it's interesting and important to us, and that is that the Stoic philosophers stressed an idea which was outrageous for the Athenians and the Greeks generally, and that is the dignity of labor, the dignity of work. And this is only a product of the Hellenistic period. That work, labor, if it's socially productive, never degrades. And here the Hellenists, the Stoics particularly, shattered what had been a great obstacle to the development of the moral stature of man, of most men, because most men can live only by working. It's only a few who can live without work. But Epictetus particularly had this concept, maybe because he had been a slave. And of course, he would never agree that his work as a slave in any way degraded him, that has degraded him, the real him. Let me quote to you a passage from Epictetus. And then you fear hunger as you fancy. Yet it is not hunger that you fear, but you are afraid that you will not have a professional cook. You will not have another servant to buy the delicacies, another to put on your shoes for you, another to dress you, others to give you a massage, others to follow at your heels, in order that when you have undressed in a bath and stretch yourself out like men who have been crucified, you may be massaged on this side and on that side, and that then the masseur may stand over you and say, move over, give me his side, you take his head, and I'll do his shoulders. And then when you have left the bath and gone home, that you may shout out, is no one bringing me something to eat? And after that, clear away the tables, wipe them off with a sponge. What? You are afraid of its, what you are afraid of is this? That you may not be able to live the life of an invalid? Since I tell you, you have only to learn the life of healthy men. How the slaves live. How the workmen live. The genuine philosophers. How Socrates lived. He too with a wife and children. How Diogenes lived. How Cleanthes, who combined going to school and pumping water. If this is what you want, you will have it everywhere and will live with full confidence. Confidence in what? In the only thing in which one can have confidence, in what is faithful, free from hindrance, cannot be taken away, that is, in your own moral purpose. And why have you made yourself so useless and unprofitable that no one is willing to take you into his house, no one willing to take care of you? But when a whole and useful implement has been thrown out, anyone who finds it will pick it up and count it gain. Yet not when he picks up you, but everyone will count you a total loss. You are so unable to serve the purposes of even a dog. Why then do you care to keep on living if that is the sort of person you are? Well, this is a new note in literature, a new note in philosophy. The dignity of the common man, the dignity of the worker, the man who makes his living, the man who doesn't rely on servants, and the man who is not a servant. He's not beholden to others. He works with his hands and with his mind and makes a living by what he does. Well, of course, modern life wouldn't be possible without this conception. Well, we've gone a long way to bring us to Thomas More. On Friday, I will begin a discussion. We will devote several hours to Utopia. And the Utopia, and in some way, the second treatise will go together, as you will see. But we'll begin on Friday.